All right, why don't we get started? Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, everybody. Much better, or a little better, I should say, not much better. Welcome to Windows Azure Internals. My name is Mark Krasinovich. How many people have seen me speak already this week? How many people saw the Azure virtual machine and networking talk that I gave? Okay, so some of you. How many people have used Windows Azure before, have actually deployed a service to Windows Azure? How many people have never, don't even know what Windows Azure is? Okay, a few of you. Well, this talk, just to set expectations, assumes that you've got some knowledge of the basics of Windows Azure, including things like fault domains and update domains. I'm going to touch on those things as I go through, but it helps if you've got that kind of understanding, if you've actually deployed a service and maybe seen my intro to Windows Azure talk, which I've delivered previously. But this session, I'm going to take you underneath the covers of Windows Azure. I think one of the really kind of cool things about Microsoft and Windows Azure is that they let me, and I get the ability, the opportunity to come out and share things like what goes on behind the scenes of how we operate our data centers, what's the infrastructure look like, even what the operations room looks like, and to talk just openly, because I think one of the things that we realize is that the cloud is nothing without trust. That's really the foundation of the cloud is you're putting your stuff on somebody else's machines, you're letting them operate those machines, you're letting them operate the infrastructure and monitor everything, keep it secure and keep it healthy. And I think from my perspective, I look at this and I say, it's really disturbing if I'm giving something to somebody else and they're like, don't worry, we'll take care of it, trust us. Because I don't know what they're doing. Like, what are you doing about security? What are you doing about infrastructure management? How does your software work? What happens if there's a failure? And so part of the earning the trust is, of course, not having problems and responding to problems effectively if we do have them. But another part of earning trust, I think, or can be accelerated, is by actually showing you what we're doing so that you can see that we're not just saying, don't look behind the curtain, everything's fine, when really it's a disaster back there. So this is the outline of this session that I put together to take you inside of Azure. First, I'll start by going into the data center architecture. And I'll talk mostly about the compute part of the architecture and the networking stack in the architecture. Then I'll take you into what happens when you deploy a service. This is probably mystery to you if you've deployed a service to Windows Azure. What is really happening when I press that publish button behind the scenes? Why does it take sometimes 8-10 minutes for my VMs to come up and the service just to report that it's healthy and start taking traffic? I'll take you behind what the steps are to get a service deployed, how we're deploying services across the data center, honoring constraints, and then what's inside of one of the servers in the data center from a software perspective. What do we have running inside there and what's going on inside of that? A key part of Windows Azure's value proposition is maintaining the health of your services. That's really one of the primary goals is keep the services healthy without you having to do much of the work. Of course, you've got to do your stuff to make your application stay healthy, but we'll keep it healthy in the face of hardware failures if you have software that is also resilient to being moved in the case of failures. That's what this service model in Azure really kind of promotes, the stateless model, which you get scale out and you get availability fairly easily. So I'll talk about some of the things we do to maintain health in the data center, and then I'll talk about the DevOps model. This is a huge shift for product groups in Microsoft. Of course, there have been many groups in Microsoft that have been running massive internet scale cloud services like Hotmail and Bing for a while. But this Windows Azure is the first platform where we're operating it, and we've got stateful tenants, meaning customers that have applications that don't tolerate failures very well because you might lose data. And we also have a situation where it's a platform where customers are using it. It's one thing if we've got something internal property that has a failure. Of course, we don't like that, but people inside the company are much more forgiving, or we can tell them to be forgiving, than somebody outside, and we're building a business by making a platform for you to come to. So the difference in mindset is the box product versus service product mindset, and I'll tell you how we operate Windows Azure with that mindset in place. And then how many people have heard of the Leap Day outage we had? So the Leap Day outage, it happened on February 29th, completely coincidental that it happened to be Leap Day. Just kidding. It was because of Leap Day. And I'll tell you what happened that day. and why there was an outage, and how we responded to the outage, and then some of the lessons that we took away from that outage and how we've been addressing the issues that led to them and actually taking a systematic look across the system to make sure something like that doesn't happen again. So first, data center architecture. This is actually a rack, and we've got a building across campus. It's what we call the Building 18 cluster, and this is where we throw the new hardware in and we play with it, and this is a rack that from that data center. This data center racks in the actual production data centers are a little bit more clean than this. The wiring's more clean and professional, and want to make sure that nobody screws up when they're unplugging wires and plugging them in or walking around and tripping on things. But it's pretty standard, actually, and this is kind of interesting because there's a top of rack switch there. Does anybody see the top of rack switch? Yeah, it's in the middle. I don't know, why do they call them top of rack switches? Does anybody know? They should be called middle of rack switches because there it is in the middle. And why is it in the middle of the rack and not the top of the rack? Shorter wires to the blades. Let's talk about the software architecture first. How many people have heard of the Fabric controller? Yeah. How many people have heard of Fabric? App Fabric. Yeah, there's overload of the terms Fabric. And I think that we use this word first, so we're claiming the word Fabric for Fabric controller. This is the component that is the heart of the compute system in Windows Azure. It's the equivalent of the kernel. I kind of view Windows Azure as a distributed operating system for data centers. And there's a lot of parallels when you look at it from an operating system lens with what Windows Server is for a single machine. If you look at them side by side, you'll see that the Windows kernel's equivalent over on the Azure side is the Fabric controller. And then at the bottom, instead of servers, we've got data centers. And then above them, we've got cloud applications, cloud services on the right, and we have Windows Server applications there on the left. As an operating system, just like a server operating system, the Fabric controller has a few key responsibilities. One of them is managing resource allocation. So in a server, the kernel is allocating physical memory and assigning it to processes. It's also allocating CPU resources and assigning them to threads. In the data center, the Fabric controller is assigning blades or slices of blades to cloud services. It's also assigning network resources to cloud services. It's also provisioning those resources. When the kernel of Windows boots, it gets the system ready. It initializes the device drivers, it initializes RAM, and gets that ready to start doling out. The Fabric controller, too, is responsible for taking these basic raw resources, these servers that get put into the data center, wired up, and then getting them integrated into the Fabric so that they can be used to host cloud services on top of. So data center resource provisioning. Service lifecycle management, well, on the server side, there's a programming model. There's an application model for Windows Server processes or applications. It's not very crisp or clean. In fact, how many people have ever tried to migrate a server application installed on one machine to another machine? Has anybody ever tried that? It's pretty hard because it's got no declarative model. In fact, many server applications are made by this thing writes here, that thing writes into this location, tweak this registry key, somebody then goes and modifies something else, and there's lots of piece components that are all doing this and spraying state. We call it spraying state all over the place. So you actually don't know when you look at the server where is the app. It's a little bit here, a little bit there, and so it makes migration very hard. When the Windows Azure project started, the project was actually started by several key members of the Windows team. In fact, one of the key members of the Windows team, or the key member, Dave Cutler, who's also architect of VMS. They left Windows and said, we're going to go work on a cloud data center operating system for our internal services. We don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past and have this model that is very dynamic, where we don't understand what an application is. Because the better the system understands the application, the more it can do for the application. And so the model is very declarative. And that model also includes a life cycle, a very distinct life cycle. How do you start the application? How do you update the application? How do you terminate the application? How do you update the configuration of the application? All of that is supported with a declarative model that I'll take you and show you if you haven't seen it before. And then finally, service health, like I said, is a key, like the reason that it's the Fabric controller exists there, to host the services and to keep them healthy. And so there's a health model, like, is the application healthy? And if it's not, How do we heal it? Is the server hardware that it's on healthy, which is causing the application not to be healthy? If not, how do we fix that and get things operating again automatically? So there's two inputs to the fabric controller, if you think about it. One is, what is the hardware it's supposed to manage? And then at runtime, what are the applications that it needs to manage? And what's the configuration of those applications that it needs to go and honor? We divide the data center into groups of servers. We call these groups clusters. So Fabric Controller manages a cluster of computers. It's approximately 1,000 servers. That's the partitioning model that we've picked for now. Could change in the future. But the reason that we divide into clusters is actually, one, we can operate them fairly independently of each other. So when we want to scale out the data center, we add another cluster, and the build out of that cluster doesn't impact or have to synchronize really with the existing operation of the clusters already there. But the other key thing that we get is fault isolation. One of the things that we learn over and over again, everybody learns, when it comes to big scale applications is you want to create bulkheads in your system where if something goes wrong, it's going to hit the bulkhead and stop spreading. And the leap day outage is an example of where the bulkhead sort of protected us and sort of didn't enough. How many people heard of Heroku's outage about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago? Does anybody use Heroku? Yeah, a few of you. They had an outage that was a case of an outage that did where they didn't have bulkheads in place. And this causes a cascading failure. So this is a deliberate design point. We're trying to be really rigorous about partitioning so that if something goes wrong, it's contained. And only subset of people are impacted. They're really pissed off. But hopefully we stop everybody from being impacted, which is even worse. So the fabric controller itself provisions the blades, manages the blades, and deploys the services. Let's take a quick look at how the fabric bootstraps, what it uses to start up. And for that, I'm going to TS into this machine, which I just had to reboot because of a network problem that I'd had. So let me get here. Actually, I'm going to do something that I'm going to show you, get ready for a demo that I'm going to show you in a little bit. The network is sluggish enough that mouse clicks aren't really responding very well. But I'm going to be opening up a tool here called Fabric. Oh, the network is really slow. Okay. Well, why don't we go Fabric Viewer. We can stop and read the news while we're waiting, I guess. Fabric Viewer. All right, we'll come back to that, just get that warmed up. Now, I was going to show you how the Fabric Controller knows what to provision. So a cluster is defined with a file called datacenter.xml, and I've got an example of datacenter.xml here for one of the clusters that I'm going to be kind of messing with as we go through this demo. This file is the file that describes what we call the CO2 stage cluster. It's the cluster of machines that we go do testing on before we roll something into production. So it's a non-production, nobody's running anything real here. There's no customers running here, which is why I'm able to get access to it and mess around with it in cool ways without worrying about pissing at least non-Microsoft people off about it. So this file is given to the fabric controller by something called the utility fabric controller. We've got a single instance fabric controller that is in charge of all the clusters in a data center. And the way that we provision a new cluster is we give the updated datacenter.xml to the utility fabric controller, and it says, oh, there's a new cluster of machines here. Here's the hardware resources assignment for it. And so it deploys a new fabric controller in its own cluster, which is what we call the utility cluster, a reserved set of blades spread across the racks of the data center. And then it starts up the fabric controller in to manage that new cluster. In fact, the fabric controller doesn't even necessarily need to be running in the same racks as the blades that it's managing. We show that, you'll see that in my diagrams, that just for convenience sake. But it's really a cluster of utility fabric clusters spread across the tops of the racks. And the UFC then hands the cluster description, the subset of the data center XML file, to the fabric controller and says, here you go. Here's your stuff to go start managing. The fabric controller then starts up and starts managing it. And I've got this datacenter.xml now here for CO2 stage. You can see data center location, CO2. And then I accidentally clicked on that, so that causes a big file to collapse XML-wise, which takes a while. So let's expand that again. And as I scroll through here, you're going to see things about networking IP addresses. These are both names of IP addresses that should be assigned to devices, as actual hardware-assigned IP addresses that the fabric controller needs to know about to be able to manipulate things. And then further down, you can start to see here the racks. Let me scroll down. Of blades. So this is still all VLAN stuff. And then here's racks of machines. And so you can see for a particular rack, it needs to know the IP address of a network switch, the serial concentrator, because this is how we get in and manually interact with the server to perform operations on it, the power strips, so each rack has dual power strips for redundancy. And then you can start to see the machines, including IDs for the NICs, as well as the blade ID, which this is a logical ID we assign to it, and then the blade IP address. And this blade IP address is then how the fabric controller is going to, what it's going to assign to that blade. It's called we call it a DIP. I think a dynamic IP address or direct IP address is what we call it, and then you can see it's from part of this machine pool right here. So this is the description that we actually feed in. This is unedited, unfiltered description that we've got of our data center racks. Now let's take a look inside of a cluster and see how the fabric controllers decompose within that. So, you know, the Windows kernel, there's a single point of failure there. It's the kernel. It's the server that it's on. We can't have a single point of failure for the fabric controller. We can't just put it on one server and say, here's the fabric controller. We get away with that for the utility fabric controller because the only thing that's responsible for is updating fabric controllers as well as deploying new ones. So it's not part of the operation of the data center. It's part of the build out of the data center and ongoing updates. But if that fails, we just restart it. If a fabric controller fails, though, what happens is that customers can no longer talk to their services through the infrastructure. You might still be able to talk to your services directly through their IP addresses that are assigned to them, because that doesn't depend on the fabric controller being up. But what does depend on the fabric controller being up is you being able to call an API, the REST API, that says, what's the state of my service? Or call a REST API that says, update my service to this new binary. And if the fabric controller fails, it can no longer maintain the health of your service. So if the server fails underneath one of your VMs, the fabric controller's down, it's not going to do its automated healing, and your application's going to experience downtime, more downtime than it would otherwise if the fabric controller was alive to detect the problem and heal your service. So it's important, very important, the fabric controller remains online all the time. So for that, we scale it out. Then we follow the same kind of design paradigms that we promote in our service model. So we create multiple instances. Now, this is a case where we've got to do something differently than what we recommend and what our service model really supports. The fabric controller is what we call a stateful service. So it maintains state of the system, you know, who's deployed where, what their states of the blades are. It doesn't store that someplace else. Really, it's the bottom of the system, and it can't store that state in Windows Azure Storage or SQL Azure. It's got to maintain it itself. And so it's a replicated stateful service, unlike what we recommend you do in your own services, which is make your lives easy, make it stateless. Because when you make something stateful, you've got to worry about leadership election and replication and the Paxos algorithm for making sure everybody agrees on what's going on. That's what this is built on. There's a Paxos ring here across these guys. There's an in-memory object store we call IMOS, which is where the state is stored for what's going on in the cluster, and that's replicated across these replicas. We generally run our clusters with 5 replicas of the fabric controller, and one of them is the primary, the leader. It when a request comes into the fabric controller, it gets routed to the leader. The leader then goes and responds to it, updates the state, makes sure that a quorum of replicas agree that they've captured that state, and then it allows actually that state transition to occur. So it's kind of a two-phase thing. We can't do it unless we assure that if somebody fails, we all have agreement about what's going on. The reason that there's five, I mean, you can get quorums with three, right? Because all you need is an odd number, or n divided by 2 plus 1 to get a quorum. But the reason we do five is to account for two things happening at the same time. One, we're updating a fabric controller, meaning that one of the instances is down because we're doing an update on it. And at the same time, a server fails on it underneath the fabric controller. So we can tolerate those two things happening at the same time by having five instances scaled out like that. Let's take a look inside of a fabric controller. And let me get this, see if my network is actually going to be a little more cooperative here. So I'm opening a build environment for the fabric that I've got installed. I'm remoted into my machine, my development machine at work. So this is actually the Microsoft Fabric build environment. It's called Razzle. So it's setting up environment variables for me. And it's going to drop me in the fabric controller source code root directory. And then I'm going to type bin. And that takes me to the output binary directory. And at this point, I'm going to connect to CO2 stage with something called FC client. Did I do a copy? And you can see I'm specifying CO2 stage app 02. This is cluster 2 in that stage data center. And at this point, I can do things like get nodes. So this is basically a diagnostic front end for the fabric. It's not what we use for standard monitoring of the fabric's operation. It's what we do when we want to go and do manual intervention on things. So it's not very optimized for performance at this point. That's why some of the calls take a while, as you're going to see, because normal operations on the fabric happen through other interfaces that are much more tuned for keeping the fabric up and running. So this is connecting to the front end, and actually this is connecting to a data center that's in the next state over from Washington. So there's a delay establishing a secure connection to that data center. And once it's done, we're going to see it spit out the node IDs. The same node IDs, if I went back to that data center XML, we'd see there, are going to come out of here. It shows us the inventory, blade-wise, of this fabric controller. And just out of curiosity, how many people manage a data center? Anybody here manage a data center? Nobody? One person? And how big is your data center? Oh, you co-locate? Okay. But do you run, so you co-locate, you let somebody else manage the infrastructure? Or are you managing the servers? I mean, are you going in there wiring things together and you are? Okay. Yeah. And so how many servers do you have there? Yeah. Anybody else have a large number of servers? 200 servers? That's a good amount. 18 servers? That's not very much. Oh, 1,800. How many? 1,800? Oh, those are good size numbers of servers. So let's see. We got our output here. Now, the exact number of servers we've got, that's something that we do like to keep confidential for competitive reasons. But I'll tell you, it's in the neighborhood of, on this order of 100,000 of servers. So that's the scale that we're operating at, and we expect to probably be doubling in the next year and a half, our scale. The demand we've seen, especially over the last 6 months, has been really pretty dramatic and exceeded our expectations, which is a good problem and a bad problem, actually. I think it's better than the reverse, though, but it's still. So here we can see the blade IDs. We can see the IP addresses, again, that were assigned there in that data center XML. And then here's the state of that blade, basically saying if it's ready or healthy. And at the bottom, there's a summary. And you can see that this data,
This cluster is pounded on pretty hard, and it's got some pretty rickety hardware in it. And so 359, I'll explain what that is. That's kind of obvious, right? Out for repair is kind of obvious. One's booting, one's powered off. So this cluster represents all sorts of states. Now, if we want to see information about a particular blade, we can do commands like this, get node details. Get rid of that space there. Whoop. Get node internals. This tool was written by developers, and so every developer comes along and adds new commands to it, and they all have slightly different syntaxes. So I'm like, oh, there's another command that has details in it. This one doesn't. That's the raw node information about a blade, and we're going to actually come back to that in a few minutes, and I'll explain what some of this output is as we get a little bit further into the internals of the Fabric controller. But you can see that each of these Fabric, that the Fabric controller is managing these racks, and that there's a top of rack router here, or a middle of rack router. Let's just call it the more. There's a more there in each of these racks. And everything in the data center is replicated, or is duplicated for high availability, except for one thing. Well, the servers, like, they're not really replicated, right? But that's the more. The middle of rack router is not replicated. Why don't we put two TORs in every rack? Because that would be very expensive. Because that means two NICs in every server with two wires coming out of it, one to each top of rack router with the two top of rack routers. And that's when the costs don't really, we don't see the cost justifying that kind of availability in these kinds of data centers. Instead, we put some of the burden on software to manage availability. So if you're familiar with the service model, and we've got this concept called fault domains, fault domains mean that we're going to spread services across single points of failure. You're looking at the single points of failure there. If you've got a service with two instances in the same role, you're going to end up on two different racks, at least. Well, you can't have more than two, right? But two. Let's take a look at data center architecture. This is a place where we've been making a lot of changes since the project started. We inherited really from global networking services at Microsoft. They'd started with a data center architecture that was really optimized for north-south traffic, is what it's called, in the data center. These are properties like Hotmail and Bing. North-south, well, request comes in from the customer and response goes out to the customer. What we see in Azure is actually a very different kind of pattern. We see a lot of north-south, of course, but we also see tons of east-west. One of the reasons we see east-west is that some of the clusters are storage clusters. So Fabric controller, we've been kind of talking about, I haven't said whether it's a storage cluster or compute cluster. We've got two types, storage and compute. And all the difference is, you've got the same Fabric controller in there, is that the storage cluster is actually dedicated to storage, the storage service in Windows Azure. Windows Azure Storage, which does blobs, tables, and Windows Azure queues. And so if you've got services that are talking to storage, which is the case, what's what we tell you to do, is stick your stuff in tables, blobs, queues, then, or another service like Service Bus or SQL Azure, you're going to be doing east-west traffic. So if you look at the amount of east-west traffic, the bandwidth, from one end of that left data center architecture to the other, it's about 120 gigabits. As you flow up, hit narrower and narrower bandwidths as you go up this tier, and then come back down. Does that sound like a big number? Well, when you consider thousands of servers underneath there, it really isn't a very big number. So it causes congestion, and there's a lot of overcommit even going north-south. So this new architecture we've got over here is what's called a CLAWS network. It's essentially fully connected, fully bisected network. Every point, there's a dedicated line from every point to every other point, every top of rack router to every other top of rack router in the data center. And the only oversubscription we've got is really at the TOR. And that's if everybody's firing out 10 gigabit at the same time. And that oversubscription is like 1.2. That's the east-west bandwidth we get with this data center architecture. That's 30 terabits. east-west. So this is what we've got rolled out now. And this is basically sets us up for the future. Another key thing that we've done with the data center architecture is that we've shifted from hardware load balancers to software load balancers. Has anybody ever had to manage a hardware load balancer? Yeah. And how much fun is that? Way too much fun. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The hardware load balancers have some issues, especially when you're operating at massive scale and you've got to have lots of them, and you've got lots of stuff underneath them. One, they're rigid, so they support fixed topologies for routing. They have limited capabilities. Basically, if you don't like the load balancer policies, you've got to wait for the manufacturer to give you support for what you'd like to do with regard to load balancing. It's not very scalable either. This is one that hits us, or hit us quite often, is ACL limits on the routers. We want to set ACLs on the IP addresses so that only certain IP addresses can talk to others. And we've got these massive networks underneath of different networks that need to talk to each other, Microsoft's corporate network, the data center networks, the data center services, and then we get this explosion of ACLs, and we end up maxing out the ACL storage for IP addresses on the routers, on the load balancers. It's also really expensive. One of these things costs on the order of $25,000, and if you want to deploy one, you need to deploy two for availability. So this stuff starts to add up pretty fast. So we've shifted away from hardware load balancing, and this is obviously, you know, the software-defined network stuff that's all going on everywhere, is get rid of the hardware stuff that's has these characteristics and move to software-controlled network. So that's what we've done here. We've gotten rid of them, and we've moved to software load balancing. Now, software load balancing, we've got a service in Windows Azure. It's called the Software Load Balancer, and the Software Load Balancer, SLB, is actually written to the Windows Azure service model, the same one that we published to you. It uses. Actually, I'll be with some little nuance there that I'll explain to you. But it's essentially the same public service model. And what this does is they very easily get the scale out and high availability that the service model promotes. Because it's in software, they can implement rich policies. And you see some of the fruits of that already with this release that we did last week, is that now we've got custom load balance probes with custom timeouts, timeout intervals, and health timeouts as well. And that's because the software load balancer enabled us to get the scales we wanted to be able to offer that policy. What in the future, you're going to see software load balancer get out to layer 7 load balancing, and you're going to see it. Are you? Okay. I hate it when my networks compete with each other. Can't they just get along? So the, like I said, rich policies is what the software load balancer lets us start to roll out. This is the architecture for the software load balancer. On the left side, we've got the fabric controller, which where APIs come in, the topology of services with load balance directions, like I want this service to have these VMs part of underneath a load balancer. What the fabric controller will do is then, it's got a component called network manager, with a load balancer engine that will then go talk to the SLB service. You see that middle is the SLB part of the SLB service. It's got the SLB manager. SLB manager is in charge of keeping track of who needs to talk to who, who's load balanced with what. And then the SLB controller then will go tell the MUX, program the MUX, which is another software component. It's a role, a scale-out role in the Windows Azure service model that then keeps those rules for how the IP packet coming in, how to take it apart, de-encapsulate it, and then who it should send it to at that point. And there's obviously another component back on the server itself, which is then doing the reverse. So when a packet comes in, it's stripped of the public IP address so that its internal IP address gets into the server, and now we need to put the external IP address back on there so whoever gets it in return sees it come from the public IP address, not some 10-dot address or whatever we've got inside the data center. And that's done by the SLB host driver there sitting inside the target server. So this is a look at how we're taking advantage of our own software architecture, and we do that with storage as well, to build out these software versions of what were previously hardware components. Let's talk about provisioning a node. So when the datacenter.xml comes in, and the UFC starts to fire up service, of course, everything is off. So the Fabric controller powers on the node, pixie boots it. So they're programmed to pixie boot, drops down a maintenance operating system. Can anybody guess what operating system that is? Windows PE, right. Windows pre-installation environment, which is the what we give to OEMs. It's what runs under MS Dart, my favorite product at Microsoft. And it is a small footprint OS. What the maintenance OS then does is formats the Windows Azure, formats the disk, and downloads a host operating system via our own technologies, Windows Deployment Services. This is kind of interesting. You know, we want to take advantage of existing software, not just go build something new. Windows Deployment Services was never designed for the scale that we've been operating at, so we've been their number one bug finder is Windows Azure, so they love us over there. They're like, thank you for all these bugs. The host OS boots. It's a generalized operating system because we follow best practices, right? Not to run NUSID, but to sysprep, like all of you. Then it specializes. And then at that point, the host agent is up and running. So this is an agent that's part of the image. Windows Azure had boot from VHD before Windows Server did. And this is a technology that was then transferred to Windows Server. So that host OS image is a VHD image. And it comes from the Fabric's image repository. You can see there up in the right. That's a repository of all the collateral, agent image, host operating system images, guest agent images, as well as the services themselves are stuck in the Windows Azure, in the Fabric controller's own repository. Let's go take a look again at some of the things that we can see inside of this now that we've seen that, because I've taken a look at one of the nodes, and we'll be able to see the images that have been downloaded to that node over time, because the images themselves cache images. Or sorry, the servers themselves cache images. So you can see some state about the node, whether it had a dirty shutdown, whether it's the maintenance operating system. And then you can start to see the current machine configuration. You can see down here the host plugins. So this is the network plugin that I just mentioned here, right there. You can see certificates so that it can securely talk to the Fabric controller, their thumbprints. And here are the cached images. And these are all different versions of operating systems. One is for the host, and several of these are for guest, because you can pick which operating system you want in your VMs when you deploy your service. You can say, I want Server 2008 from version whatever they were at, 122, which happens to be from 6 months ago. If that service then had a VM get deployed here, that image would get cached on this server. So the next time somebody wanted it, it'd already be there. You can see here app VHDs. I'll talk more about those, but you can probably guess these are cloud service packages, VHDs that represent roles that are being deployed here. And then we scroll down, we can see information about about the roles that are deployed, their tenant names, the service name, ID that's assigned to them, the state, and so on. And then these are VMs here's a VM, which we call them containers. And then within a container, you can see a role that's deployed in that container, which I'll show you more about in a second. And then at the very bottom of this display, we can see things like a summary of that server's history in terms of counts, how many times it's rebooted, workflow count since a certain time, and then its disk layouts. So hardware information about it, too, is also added here. Let's talk about deploying a service now. So the way that you deploy a service, you've probably done it in Visual Studio through Publish, or you've gone to RDFE, the front end, where you can say, here's a package to upload, or you can use PowerShell APIs to go deploy a service. What's going on is the package gets uploaded to the portal. This is the interactive flow. REST APIs then are used to give that package to a service called RDFE, Red Dog Front End. Does anybody know what Red Dog, where that name came from? I'm sure somebody's heard this lore. Person in the back? Red Dog, no, it's not an Australian movie about it. Close, it's a really close guess. Anybody? That's it. Wow. It's a code name for Azure, no. And actually, I meant where that code name came from. Yeah, it has something to do with Dave Cutler. So Dave Cutler, I mentioned, was the guy, one of the first people that went and started the Red Dog project. He was on a trip down to San Francisco to visit our data centers there, our Hotmail data centers, and to look at what's going on. And they're driving around, and at the time they're like, hey, we need a code name for this thing. And so they passed an establishment called the Pink Poodle. And so they didn't go in there, as far as I know. But Dave liked the name. I don't know why. Maybe it's the sign, you know, the dog on the sign looked cool. But so he said, let's call it Pink Poodle. No, and everybody's like, no, we can't call it the Pink Poodle. So they said, okay, let's call it Red Dog. That's, you know, more, I guess, politically correct. Anyway, if you'll take a look at it. So I actually haven't been to that place either. Has anybody been to this place? And I haven't found anybody that will raise their hand and admit it. But I did an internet search, and it probably is what you think it is. So now RDFE sends this package to the particular cluster. So it picks a cluster to send it to, and then the fabric stores that image in its repository and then starts to do the next phase. RDFE is the front end, like I said. It manages subscriptions, it manages billing, it manages user access to services, so it's where the authentication happens, and the service management APIs, when you call PowerShell scripts to deploy services, create virtual machines now, create VNets, that's all going through RDFE. RDFE is responsible, like I said, for picking clusters, and which cluster it can send to depends on what you've told it. So you go in the portal or in the REST APIs and you say which region you want to deploy to, or so we call them subregions, I guess. You can say North Central, for example. And when you say deploy to that, then you kind of narrowed the choices for RDFE. You can even go further and be more precise. You can say, I've created an affinity group, and that affinity group, if it already has a service or a storage account deployed to it, that also is much more precise. It says this part of the data center close to this other service that I already have deployed there. If it has a choice, like if you just said North Central, then it's going to pick which cluster based on utilization of that cluster of the clusters. So it's going to pick the most lightly utilized to try to balance things out. I'm actually going to show you the utilization algorithm just for a second because it's very confidential. There it is. Okay. That was the algorithm that lots of, it's actually, that is it. So it should be pretty obvious what we're doing there. I can't tell you that, actually. No, actually, I don't even know. I just copied that from our spec, so. No, but actually that algorithm is basically take the VIPs. So we've got two resources that are kind of measure utilization. One is the number of cores that are available, and the other one's the number of virtual IP addresses. Each fabric controller gets a pool of the public IP addresses to work from. Let's take a look at the service model now underneath. The service model undergoes actually several translations. When you give it to us, RDFE takes it and validates against a schema. And that schema, there's an external one and there's an internal one, or actually there's multiple schemas. The one that you're using for published features is the public schema. And we can tag certain accounts or subscriptions as being having access to internal schemas or schemas that have unpublished features in them. And so what that means is that if you write a service, like when we were doing this virtual machine feature, we were giving access to people to go test with it, you know, under NDA, and they were able to create services that reference that schema, but then give it to us and we could say, is this subscription validated, you know, authorized to use this schema? So that's the way we kind of roll out new features under control, is using the schemas that RDFE validates against subscriptions. RDFE takes that, shreds it up, and then puts it in a format for the fabric controller, which is a much more low-level service model the fabric controller's got that includes advanced service concepts like native hardware and role location. The fabric controller itself uses its own service model for deployment, and I've got that example of that service model. Actually, it was right there. Right here. This is the fabric controller's service model, and this is what it looks like. If you've looked at CSDEF and CSCFG, which I'll show you in a second, is very different. Some of the things that this lets the fabric do is that a native, you know what a container is. Well, containers don't really map to VMs. They map to role hosts in the fabric. And a native one means you get the whole hardware. You get the server. The fabric controller runs on the native server, so it specifies that. It also has the ability to co-locate roles in the same container. Here's the data center manager, and here's the fabricator. There are two roles, both running inside of that container. So those are features that we haven't made public yet, but are supported in the service model. Has anybody looked at the service model that you end up creating when you use Visual Studio? Anybody? A few people? Here's what that looks like. This is an app that I've actually deployed to CO2 Stage, my own little test app. It's got a web role here, and you can see it's declarative. Configuration settings are defined here. Imports of modules, how our VIPs are allocated, and here's a worker role. So it's two roles. And then I also have a configuration. It's my CO2 configuration that I created for this, which specifies storage strings for CO2 Stage, as well as the plugins, whether they're enabled or not, and their configuration, and the instance count. This is part of the declarative model. We're going much, much further. So this is basically dipping our toes into the service declarative model. What you'll see coming from us within the next year probably is we'll roll out a service model that's much more comprehensive about resource types. Right now it's just compute and network, but you're going to see it also include things like Service Bus, SQL Azure, storage, so that you can declaratively model your application, deploy it, and then we know what it looks like. Then RDFE converts it. The fabric controller converts it to an internal model. As far as deployment steps, it's fairly straightforward. The fabric controller shreds the service model, figures out the allocation, computes where it needs to put the service or the pieces of the service, places the role images on their nodes, talking to the host agent, sticking them in the node image repositories that we were just looking at, creates the virtual machines, starts them, and then configures the networking in parallel. So it's assigning these dynamic IP addresses to the individual VMs. It's also assigning VIPs and programming the load balancer to start forwarding traffic to the front end, to any of the roles instances that you've got mapped to the VIP. Let's take a look. I'll show you where my allocation is of branding police in CO2 Stage in a second in a viewer. But the resource allocation has hard constraints and soft constraints. The hard constraints are, what are your fault domain requirements for your instances? If you've got four instances, two fault domains, we need to spread them across at least two fault domains. We have to, because we made that promise to you. So that's one thing that narrows where we can put them. What size VMs are they? That'll narrow the list of servers as well. Soft constraints are, we'll try to pack them together so that we minimize fragmentation of our servers. And it also has a secondary effect that it makes locality for you. If you've got the front-end role sitting on the same server as a back-end role, they're going to be co-located and not have to go out even onto the network. Produces the goal state and then drops them into the system. So let's go take a look at where branding police is in the fabric viewer. And I've got a locally stored snapshot of what the CO2 Stage looked like just a little while ago. So this will populate in a second. And here's a look at that CO2 Stage cluster. You can see the racks. This is a small cluster. It only has eight racks in it. Nine racks. Is it nine racks? It should be 10. Is there a scroll? Yeah. There's the other one. So it wrapped at this resolution. And the green represents VMs. And kind of the size of them, the relative size of the VMs on the servers that they're hosted on. You saw these unhealthy and healthy human investigate servers in the output of the FC client. Where's my service, my branding police? Well, here's the portal. I've deployed branding police here. You can see that there's the worker role, there's the web role, there's the two instances. I can grab the deployment ID and go and plug it in here, and it'll show me where it is, highlighted in this green color. And so there's two of the instances, and here's another two of the instances. So two of them are on one server and two of them are on the other server. So what does that tell us about which roles those VMs are part of? Well, to satisfy the hard constraint that it's got to be split across fault domains, we know that on that server in the bottom left, one of those is web role and one of those is a worker role. We can use FC client commands too to see where get tenant nodes containers. Let's do that one. And I'll plug in that same thing. And what this is going to do is tell us where the roles are. So here's one. This is a worker role here on blade number and then E28. So you can see one is a web role, just like I said, and one is a worker role. One's a web role and one's a worker role on this other server right here. So validating what we just had to, what we just inferred based on the requirements. And this is what basically it looks like. We pick the nodes, co-locate them if we can across the roles, and then wire up the load balancer to the front ends. And then you've got your mycloudapp.net. Inside of a node, it's Hyper-V's architecture. Anybody familiar with virtualization? This slide looks right. You're going to be right at home with this slide because it is Hyper-V underneath. There's a host partition or a root partition, however you want to call it. There's the agent in there. There's VMs hosting the roles. As part of our PaaS, we stick a role agent in there. And you might have seen role agent inside of the image repository on the server. The guest agent's responsible for talking and communicating with you, infrastructure to you. So when your role starts answering our pings, our health pings, and you tell us you're ready, then that's what tells us, hey, it's okay to start sending the load balancer through to you. And we also send in information like topology. So you can use the PaaS APIs to say, what are the IP addresses of the worker roles that I've got as part of my service? And when you deploy a role instance, the steps are the Fabric controller pushes the role code, configuration to the target servers. Then it creates three VHDs, a differencing VHD for the OS drive. Because there's a golden master OS image on that server, we don't want you to mess with it. So we put a differencing VHD between you and it. So your VM then can party on your OS, and only you see it. Somebody else can share the same base image, and they're partying on their own differencing VHD. If we want to reset you, like you say repave, there's a re-image VM or re-image role instance API. What we just do is delete the role instance VHD, the differencing VHD, and create a brand new one. And now you've basically started out with that fresh OS image again. Well, there's a resource VHD for your temporary files. This is your, when you say local temporary storage, that's what that is. It's a dynamic VHD, so you just write into it. That's where the paging file goes. When that role, your role gets deleted off the server, we just delete it. And then the role VHD for the role files. Host agent then creates the VM, attaches the VHDs, and starts the VMs. Guest agent starts the role host, which calls your entry point, and that's when you start getting the heartbeats as part of our health model. And so this is what it looks like VHD topology-wise. Now, this is inside of a role VHD, just a screenshot of this is the D drive. This is that Windows differencing VHD on top of the host. This is the C. You can see the paging files here. That's the resource volume. And then here's where your role code gets stored. And that actually is where the role files. So this is, for example, my role.dll is what you produced out of Visual Studio and dropped in there, along with the DLLs you've got. This is a screenshot of Process Explorer, and you can see that there's the guest agent that's going to be talking to you. It starts as a child, or the host for your DLL, which starts as a child of the guest agent. So we can detect if your entry point crashes, then the guest agent then will go and automatically heal that. And we also can heartbeat you through that worker host. Let's talk about infrastructure as a service. And while I start to talk about that, let me get a demo ready. And again, I apologize for having to do this in front of you. This was all set up and ready to go before the networking problem I ran into. So I'm going to show you some of the things that we're working on when it comes to our virtual machine performance. In previous internals talks, I've talked about the things we're doing to improve the performance of platform as a service, the web and worker roles, and the deployment. We're also hard at work on our infrastructure as a service. So infrastructure as a service, their topology is a little bit different. Here's what it looks like. You've got a VM. You've got a virtual disk driver underneath. And based on, depending on the caching policy for your VM, you either get a local cache, which is partially in RAM. You get some amount of RAM for your cache, and you get some of the host RAM, and you get some amount of disk also for the cache. And anything that misses the cache goes back to the blob where you stuck your VHD in Windows Azure Storage. If you have no caching policy turned on, then you go right to the blob. And if you saw my session on Monday, you know that the OS disk caching policy is by default on, write cache policy. Flushes and write-throughs still go back to the back end. But data disks have no cache by default. And that's because for large data sets with lots, especially SQL workloads, we found that Windows Azure Storage does a better job of delivering IOPS than the spinning disks that are local on the servers. So that's why that's off by default. Let me see if I can get this ready for you. This is optimized boot. And these are actually ready to go. So today, let's talk about the performance improvements. Our goal is to get to less than 5 minutes from the time you press create VM or the API is called to you being able to RDP in. Today, in our preview environment, it's about 8 to 9 minutes. Part of that is the boot of Windows Server 2012. It's about 3.5 minutes. Server 2008 is about 4.5 minutes. It's roughly in this range. Now, the optimizations are in the works, pre-populating a boot cache, not writing back during provisioning because at that point you haven't touched it, so it's okay if the thing fails and we lose data because we'll just restart it. Multiple asyncs write and doing read ahead. So all of these optimizations are being rolled out in the next few months. Here's the pre-populated boot cache, which I'm going to show you right now, as soon as I deal with my slow network situation here and get these side by side for you. Oh, this is painful. Painful. All right. But I think we can do it. It's worth it, I think. Because what I've got on the left side here is what we've got in preview. And what I've got on the right side is what I'm going to show you, which is I'm going to show you that there's a cache file here, which is a small cache file. This is basically just a differencing VHD, which is the local disk cache. So we're going to show you operating system performance improvements. What we're going to do is boot the VM with this command, PowerShell command, gen prefetch. What gen prefetch does is boots the VM, watches it populate, watches what it pulls in from Windows Azure Storage into the local cache, that cache file, and then generates, that's what it does right then. That's what it does right then. The next step I'm going to do is it's going to look at what blocks came from Windows Azure Storage, generate a prefetch map, and then go and put at the end of the VHD, there's a 16 megabyte partition there that we stick the prefetch map into of the blocks of the VHD that were read during the boot process. So we've just booted, and now I'm going to download that prefetch map. And the next thing I'm going to do is boot these side by side. The left is preview, and actually this is a little bit slower than what we've got in preview on the left side because there's reads back to blob store. This is actually sitting under my desk in my office, and it's talking to the Building 18 storage cluster. So this is how I can, we're actually remoted into servers. Sorry, in case I didn't make that clear, these are blades. So if they happen to be sitting under my desk, but they're wired up to talk to Windows Azure Storage and Building 18. So this is the actual OS's environment that we're running. And what I'll do, I've got these two VMs here that we're going to boot. You can see Preview Perf and Windows 8 IaaS. And the next thing we're going to do is, well, if you take a look at the cache now, it's a 1 gigabyte now file. It's expanded with prefetch. And we're ready to go. So time start. It's really not a race because it's not fair. So I give that one a head start. Now that VM is going to start up. You can see starting. And we don't have to wait and take a look at this, but within a short period of time, the machine on the right side is going to have finished booting, and we'll see a message spit out saying how long it took. And then after that, but the definition of boot here is when the VM, the guest agent in the, the guest integration components, Hyper-V, sends out a heartbeat into the hypervisor. Then we say, oh, the VM's alive. So there are 22 seconds, we get the heartbeat. Now the next phase is when the thing is actually up and has hit the point where the agent inside the VM talks to us, which means at that point it's essentially ready to RDP into. And that's going to take another roughly a minute on the right side. And while that's waiting, this is what happens. Downloads the prefetch file, prefetches the data first, and then launches the VM. And so that's, let's see, I'm still working on it. Let's talk about updating the host operating system. About once a month, and you might have heard this before, you can guess why we're doing this. We have to update the servers, the software on the servers. And we do have to do it in a way that honors your update domains. So familiar with update domains, we can't take down two of update domains of a role at the same time, which means we have to do this graph coloring of where we place things in the data center so that we can quickly reboot every server to pick up the new host OS. And this is actually a really fun problem that I dug into, and I'm working with MSR, come up with a new algorithm. It's essentially graph coloring with constraints that are specific to our update domains and VM sizes and so on. And it's actually an algorithm that's going to speed up the way how fast we can. It's probably going to, depending on the utilization of the clusters, speed up the number of steps it takes to update a cluster, taking it down from 60 steps down to 20 steps. So, and we're probably going to get a patent on that. So that was a lot of fun. But that happens about once a month. We're moving, if you've listened to me on Monday, we're working on trying to get to a less frequent patch frequency, because one of the things we do is just blindly take the patches. We don't, and the only reason to actually take a patch is if it's really part of our security surface area. Well, in a hypervisor in the host OS, there's not much of a surface area there. It's not like there's untrusted code running on it. It's not like we've got IE there. It's not like we've got people running stuff in win32k.sys and doing an elevation of privilege. So these are things that we can skip, but we haven't just sat down and worked with the security compliance people and everybody that needs to sign off and, you know, believe that it's really not a risk not to take those things. But once we can get over that, then we can start just taking only the ones that are part of our surface area, which would be a lot fewer. Talk about service health now. The fabric maintains health by monitoring for software health based on heartbeats. And the operations it takes are pretty straightforward. It basically lets you, if a role instance crashes, like I said, the guest agent restarts it. If a server starts to go out to lunch, the fabric controller stops getting heartbeats from it and will restart it. And then once it restarts it, if it doesn't respond in a certain amount of time, it'll try it again. And then has a certain number of retries before it gives up. This is a quick breakdown of hardware issues by percentage based on hardware, and no surprises here. Disks keep going up and up until we replace the disks, and then they go down, and then they go up and up and up, and then we replace the disks and they go down. That is the part that basically has this long, the primary driver of data center fragility is spinning media. What we do when the server fails underneath your VM is we call it service healing. We've got to go and basically make sure that the thing is shut off so that it's not rogue. We use the PDUs to remotely, the fabric controller uses the PDU to remotely to shut down the server, and then migrates the VMs to another server until it finds another placement, and then gets it restarted. So this is what that looks like. Let's say that server failed with those instances on it. We'd find another set to deploy it to. So that's pretty straightforward. Let's talk about developing Windows Azure. There's multiple teams. And the number of teams grow and grow as we get more and more of the company behind Azure and we get more sophisticated services going into the platform. We can't release all at the same time. Everybody's on their own cadence. But we do have a release pipeline so that the deployment team can keep track of what's going on and make sure that the data centers are accessed securely while rollouts are happening. And so this is a chart, just an example of some of the components that we're rolling out, the various stages that they move through from testing to integration to stage to then to production. And production means rolling them out across all our data centers, across all the regions we're in, so that can take a few days as well. We monitor our services heavily using an internal monitoring system, and what that monitoring system does is spits out, there's an aggregation service that's part of that monitoring system. So data is being spewed from services, from the servers, into tables in Windows Azure Storage, and then there's an aggregation system on top of it that goes and mines that data coming out for anomalies, for trends. So here's a trend report. And we can actually do rich queries on the data, like this basically is a query, very SQL-like, that says, you know, give me the counts of threads on this fabric controller in the data coming from this table. So this is over the course of a day. And what we do is monitor stuff like this. Well, if the number of threads drops, well, maybe that's a problem. You can see there probably that fabric controller server was rebooted or failed. We also have what's called a canary. These are every cluster, and every rack in every cluster has an extra small VM, a shared core VM in it that does nothing but just talk to everybody else. So this is kind of testing the system from the perspective of a customer's eyes. Can that instance, can it talk to Microsoft.com? Can it talk to the cluster next door? Can it talk to the rack? Can it talk to these other data centers? And they just do that all day long. It's kind of like people on Twitter. This is what these guys are like. It's the Facebook generation in our data centers. And here's the heads-up display we see. So this is actually a screenshot. Those red ones are being upgraded with new Canary instances, which is why they're red. All developers, this is the difference in kind of operations from box product, is all developers spend time getting an on-call, rotating through on-call. Now, I'm a certain level in the company, so I can say I'd rather not do that. But it's really just the price of business at this point with services. I'm going to show you a video now to show you why the DevOps model is so important. This is a video tour that I took on Friday. Network operations room for all of Azure Worldwide.
Operations manager here at Windows
is down the hall. Actually, let me restart that so I didn't speak over him. And see if we can fix the volume. But this is the operations center. It's literally two doors down from my office at work, and I walked in there Friday and said, hey, let's shoot a video to see. I think people will be interested in seeing.
Hi, my name is Julian Gonzalez. I'm operations manager here at Windows Azure, and this is our operations room.
So on the left-hand side, towards the back, those are customer service folks. They're currently working on customer service problems and helping out our customers resolve their issues. On the right-hand side, we have a deployment team, and they're currently working on some deployments. We deployed 24/7, almost 365 days a year, except for a couple of holidays. And on this side, we have our build-out team. Say hi. RJN Srikant. And they currently are working on our build-outs, technically not operations, live-site operations, because they're building out new clusters every day, and before they're actually in a go-live state, but they sit in here as well, and building quite a few, as the demand is high. And then on the right here, we have on this table, we have our live-site operations. There's Robin and Bismi.
Hey.
And they perform our live-site operations, so that would be your typical live-site operations team, and we do. These two guys are supporting all of our clusters across all the data centers worldwide.
So the five screens you see here are our heads-up displays, and these show this is just a snapshot of our current state of our environment.
Actually, I'll stop there. What what he was going to do is walk down. There's four monitors there, and one of them is monitoring network. Another one's monitoring the state of the clusters. Another one's monitoring buildouts and customer support incidents. But I think, how many people did you count in there? About 10 people. That is for Azure Worldwide. And actually, some of them aren't really operating Azure. There's really two guys there in the front right. Those are LifeSite. Those are people that are actually looking at what's going on across this order of 100,000 servers across the world to see if there's a problem. Two people. Now, this kind of drives home this, because when there's a problem, if they can't solve it, they're on the phone to these guys. And actually, there's the going through rotation, actually, it's like you don't want to be the guy picking up the phone in the middle of the night because the guy down the hall screwed up. So it also reinforces, I think, code quality, too, doing this, too. So there's a picture. You saw that. All right, so leap day outage. I've just got a few minutes left, so I'm going to walk through this fairly quickly. But it reinforces, I think, the concepts and architectures that I've described so far. You're going to understand exactly what happened. This is the timeline of interesting events. There are two phases. Now, the first phase, well, first of all, let's talk about how a node gets provisioned. I mentioned the guest agent. Well, it creates what is called a transport certificate to establish a secure channel with the host agent. And then once that secure channel is established, everything's green, we're good to go and able to use it. Leap day bug, well, we tried to create that certificate, and guess what? We set an expiration date that happened to be February 29th of 2013. Because it was like, oh, generate a cert that lasts a year, take year plus one. Anybody made that mistake before? Actually, I think everybody makes that once in a while. Actually, .NET makes you not do it, but this is code written. This is native code. So in any case, what happens is no cert. There's a timeout, 25 minutes. The host agent says, you're not in good shape. I can't hear you. Let me retry that three times. You're still not in good shape. Start time to consider this whole node bad, because the only reason that a VM shouldn't be able to start like this is a hardware problem, right? Because we're so good at software. Well, notice that we've moved this machine into that human investigate state that you saw. But these VMs they're running along healthy, although their guest agents are bad guest agents. Because if they had to recreate the cert, which is going to happen if you repave your OS, for example, or deploy a new package, then they're going to run into the same problem. But for now, they're good. So what happens is that service healing, which I talked about, happens. Because the node has gone bad, we take everybody off, all those VMs, and reincarnate them someplace else. Leap day starts. VMs go bad, like you saw. We HI those nodes. We migrate the VMs. 75 minutes later, boom. So this is really is a virus. Now, there's a couple things. So we have a threshold. We've got breaks. First of all, clusters are all independent, but this was a bug that affected all of them. But we've got a break that says after 60 nodes in a cluster go bad, stop everything, because something's wrong. So after 60, the whole node, the whole cluster, basically, we move it into human investigate, turn off service healing, turn off APIs to it. It's basically shut down while humans can go figure it out. Now, leap day hit in Pacific time at 4 p.m. Friday afternoon. Guess what time the alarm went off saying something's wrong? Yeah, well, isn't it 4:15? Oh, 25 times 3, 75 minutes. Yeah, whatever that math is. 4 o'clock plus 75 minutes. That's 5:15, right? Yeah, 5:15. Alarms go off. On call. You know, LifeSite's like, what the hell is going on? Call the on-call guy. On-call guy says, that's interesting. Let me call somebody else that might know what's going on here. So he calls the guy that writes the host agent. He gets him on the phone like a few minutes later, and he goes, oh. So as far as it impacting customers, you can see that there's three customers here. Depending on where they were located at the time that the brakes hit, they might have been fine or might not have. So customer one, totally down. Customer two, well, some of their VMs are down. And customer three, hey, everything's cool. This is kind of the random effect it had on people. So what we did was decide, okay, we need to fix the GA and the HA. Clusters were in two different states, though. Some of them were in the middle of their own host OS update. So we were actually contributing to the virus because we were rebooting VMs with new hosts, recreating the guests, you know, in them. The host agent also had this bug. So we were actually accelerating the spread of this ourselves. It would have happened even if no customers were doing anything. So we decided to do two things, because some of them were almost fully updated to the next release, 1.19. Some of them were only partially, had just started. So we said, oh, the new ones, let's just keep them on 1.19. The old ones, it'd take too long to move everybody forward and then fix them there. So let's just reset them back to 1.18 and apply the fix there. So the updated clusters, the ones that are in 1.19, package networking plugin, 1.19, host OS, 1.19, deploy it, reboot, cool. Everything's cool. And these guys are unaffected. Now we can deploy the guest agent now that the host is healthy and everything is nice. How about the partially updated ones? Well, anybody see a problem with that package we deployed? Actually, it shouldn't have been a problem, but it is. 1.19 host agent not compatible with 1.18 network agent. Somebody had missed when they were creating the custom package the fact that they needed to update, networking plugin as well. So then what happens is the machine boots fine, but it can't talk to the network. Now these machine boots, you know, resets fine, can't talk to the network. Now we turned a bad problem into, really, really bad problem. So seven clusters removed into this inconsistent state out of all the clusters we had. So the recovery for the, and at this point, that decision to roll back was made at 4 in the morning. And at this point, it was like 6 in the morning. It's like, oh, crap, what do we do now? Well, those clusters are completely off broken anyway. So let's just blast. Instead of doing the thing where we honor SLAs by marching through update domains and doing that walk that I told you about, we'll just do a blast. So we blast out the new thing. Now the network comes back. The problem is that that's supposed to be green. Yeah, it's the template messed me up. But what happens now is, oh, it's actually supposed to be red, sorry, because they're red because these VMs are still broken. So now we need to update the GAs. So now we have to do this manually because service healing is off because there's not enough healthy nodes. We can't use the automated deployment for the guest agent. So we got to do it one by one using that tool that you just saw. And so finally, you know, like at 5 in the afternoon, or 3 in the afternoon, something like that, the next day, things are cool. So our learnings from this, time can be a single point of failure. Who knew? Cascading failures, recovery can actually trigger cascading failures, not just faults. We need a safe mode. We need to be like, what if things go wrong? We still need to be able to access things and do things. So, and customers, when the clusters were service healed, they couldn't even if their VMs were healthy, you couldn't query their status of your service because the REST APIs were all down. Fabric was like, I'm not talking to anybody. So we need a read-only mode. Recovery should all be done through the normal path. Some of the on-call people there, you know, by the time this is in full swing, there's, you know, 15 people in that ops room we were looking at working on this problem, and some of them hadn't slept in like 24 hours, 36 hours. So, and that's when bad decision making. We know that decision to roll back instead of roll forward, not good. So people need sleep, and customers obviously need to know what's going on. We weren't as good as we should have been telling people what was happening. We published a blog post about 10 days later telling you, basically just telling you what I just told you. But we've learned a lot, and we've made a ton of improvements, and, you know, we're pretty we're actually really super incredibly confident that's never going to happen again. But this is the aspiration for what we want to get to, where the fabric controller is actually just this autonomous, artificially intelligent thing. Maybe 100 years from now. But. And so that brings me to the conclusion. So I hope that this gave you a little bit of a feeling for how we run things and how things are architected in Windows Azure. Next time you're deploying a service, you know what's going on behind the hood. You also know what the people look like when they're sitting there watching what's going on, and hopefully instills you with a little bit of confidence that we actually are applying sound engineering and science to what we're doing and wanting to make an awesome platform for you to put your stuff on. So thanks very much. Please fill out an email. I've got one more talk tomorrow. Hope to see you there.